Hello listeners, and welcome to the AfriWit podcast, where we look to celebrate African history, people and culture by telling our story. As always, our hope is that it fills you with enough curiosity to go into your own deeper research. Karibuni to any new listeners to the AfriWit world. We invite you to check out previous AfriWit episodes, which can be found on this podcast platform. Thank you so much for tuning in today as we head over to East Africa for part one of the Karagwe Kingdom. A shout out to my East Africans out there, AfriWit has landed on your borders. Before we begin, please remember to visit us on our socials. Our handle is at AfriWit, where we shall be posting interesting facts, stories, updates, and links for further study for all you lovely people. But for now, just sit back and enjoy the journey. So, obviously, to those of you who know the drill, you'll already know what time it is. Yep, map time. For our first time AfriWatu, join us in opening up the maps of this beautiful continent we call home. The Kingdom of Karagwe was located in what is now the intersection of modern-day Burundi, Rwanda, Tanzania, and Africa's largest lake, which has a few names, one being Lake Ukerewe, which is named by the Kerewe people from the southern shores of what is today's modern Tanzania, where Karagwe is domiciled. And all of these within our East African interlacustrum. Interlacustrum, why? It was bordered by Lakes Rushwa, Lweru to its west. It had Lake Burigi to the southeast. And to the east, it had the Kiziba Kingdom. To the northwest of the kingdom, River Kagera acted as a natural border with kingdoms such as Rwanda, Mvororo, and Nkole. So now we all know where we are today. Let's get a little bit more background to just continue to set the scene and the context. So the Karagwe Kingdom had steadily grown in power and influence from the 15th century, peaking in the 19th century, and it had been led by some of the most powerful rulers in the region. We shall discover many of the other dope things about this kingdom in the course of this and the next episode. But for now, I just wanted to pull out a few identifiers or terms that we shall encounter and then clarify them before we continue. Cool? So the first is a title for the ruler, because where else do you start but from the top? And in the course of the research, there were different terms that came up. The most common ones that I found were Omugabe and Mukami. For the purposes of this episode, I picked the former, but that does not mean the latter is not an official title. And in fact, AfriWit would really appreciate to hear from our Karagwe fan their versions as well. Then from there, we come to a very prominent group within Karagwe, who were the Basita or Babito dynasties. They were said to have come from the north, and some claim they came under the guise of refugees in the 14th century. And they had come from what we know as the Chitara Empire, which had been under the Bachwesi rule. They were said to have left and then arrived and conquered the Banyambo, which nicely leads us to the people of Karagwe, the main population and among the, we call the older settlers. In fact, sometimes some of them do argue that they were the original settlers, and they are referred to as, you guessed it, the Banyambo. Then within the people, we also have subgroups or clan, and we see a very powerful clan, the Bahima, who dominated the Karagwe nobility, particularly in the years after Ruhinda came and conquered the lands in the late 15th and early 16th century. Sometimes they call the Bahima, Bahinda, Bahina. So we'll try and stick to Bahinda for now. And in the course of this and the next episode, you shall hear all of these terms. And I just thought it's best to highlight them now to really help in getting into the vibe of the kingdom from the get-go. So now, the best part about our history, well, it is to Afriwetu, is the story of how our ancestors and their civilizations came to be. It's always intriguing, and our Karagwe ancestors do not disappoint, so here we go. Now, the first thing to say is that there are a number of versions, so I'm just going to pull out a few. So, the first part of one of the origin stories actually starts with the Bashwezi way back when. And there's actually claim by the descendants that Karagwe was actually a part of their ancient empire. And for those of you Afriwatu who have been with us for a while, thank you, you will remember we covered them in season 1, episode 14. And for those of you who haven't yet heard, please go back and catch up with us. For this episode, we shall look at the later years, which are more relevant to Karagwe, with the main protagonist as well as founder being Ruhinda across the board in all the stories. So apart from the Bachwezi and the Chitara, there were many other players in Karagwe's origins, with each one's role intertwined and their various versions of how these play out. So at Afriwetu, we shall look, as usual, at the more common threads in the different tales. It's worth noting that there's also a difference of opinion as to whether or not Karagwe eventually or was ever a part of the empire, as I mentioned before. And actually, those who propose it isn't argue that actually the link to the empire was superimposed by those who conquered Karagwe, and that the Bahinda, you know, Ruhinda, Bahinda, following their invasion and having taken over, were the only ones who had this linkage, and they backdated it. So it was really essentially foreign and not native to the Karagwe peoples. But before we get into all that, let's begin at the very beginning, back to Ruhinda's conquests. Afriwetu, taking the notion that Ruhinda was not so much directly expanding the empire, hence the whole discussion around whether or not Karagwe was part of the empire, but in fact that he was establishing his own political and territorial power base. He was actually escaping, well, would you say escaping? But he was actually in the course of trying to expand this because his own home was undergoing some serious political upheaval and shifts. And this impacted his family directly. In fact, his father, in particular, was overthrown by the new dynasty that came in, the Babito. And it is in the midst of all of this, when it had all settled, and Wamara, who was his father, had been unseated, that Ruhinda had left with the royal drum and other royal artifacts. He had the duty of keeping these safe and out of reach from the usurpers. And it was upon him, as his father had already taken flight, it was said, and it was on him to stay, fight, and reclaim his family's authority. But even then, Ruhinda had to eventually let go of this claim. He then, leading his followers and family out of their homes, went out to search for new lands. The story of how he ended up at Karagwe has a number of versions, and for Afriwatu, it seems that honestly, this should be its own Legends episodes, right? But for the purpose of today, here's a very, 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 very quick summary of just before he landed at Karagwe. So, Ruhinda having fled his homeland, he and his followers, including his father and family, got to safety at Bigo. Having settled them in, he continued on his quest. And then on coming back to the new home, he found that it had been raided and most of his family had been killed. He then took the survivors to look for a new home and settled them all at Karokarungi, which is now we know as Nkole. Whilst there, he took over the polity and then left his son, Nkumba, as their ruler. Our restless Rohingya still wanted to travel and conquer, and so upon landing at Karagwe, he defeated the existing rulers and claimed authority using the royal drum, Nyabatamba, and insignia. He then declared Buranyage as his new capital, and from there he ruled and built what was to be the new phase of the Karagwe kingdom. There is another version worth mentioning, and this one states that Rohingya is said to have happened upon what was Karagwe as he was heading southwards from his homelands. Upon getting there, he was not warmly received. And this is because he did not follow the proper protocol in giving advance notice to the existing establishment. And the fine for this was imprisonment, so he was detained. He was eventually released, and once that was done and he was pardoned from the serious oversight of diplomatic procedure, he left. Obviously, this was not the end of the story, because much later on, we see him return, and this time as part of a large expedition and on the forefront leading the expansion of what was the Bunyoro Chitara Empire. It's an interesting take, right? Afriwatu, please share any other origin stories so we can share them with our other Afriwatu as well. Now, there has been debate as to whether or not Rohingya was a real man or a great myth. And after we delve into a little bit more of his story for the Legends episode, the decision, to be honest, will be yours to make. Here at Afriwetu, though, spoiler alert, we take it that he was indeed a real live man. But we would love to get the view from the descendants in the region, so please hit us up and let us know. Now, the archaeology, still in the origins. And it feels like this has become a thing now at Afriwetu, right? Anyway, what we do know as fact is that even before Rohingya arrived, there was a fully fledged civilization in place at Karagwe, the one he found and conquered. The people, the Manyambo, traced the kingdom's origins to way before the invasion, far enough to some even claiming it to be from the beginning of time itself and from the heavens. There are archaeological digs that show the settlement in the area of communities that were hunter-gatherers in the Stone Age at least 500,000 years ago. They used stone tools for everyday life activities. From then, if we leap forward in time by like a lot, we land in the 5th century AD, and the dwellers were an agricultural community who farmed and harvested mainly millet, yams, and sorghum. These folk were not necessarily the original indigenous people, and it is theorized that they had arrived from the southwestern parts of the continent as part of a mass migration. This migration is said to have happened in two waves, the first between the 5th and the 10th centuries, and this group then split into one that remained and established roots, and the rest who continued on the journey up to the north. And then the next wave, moving in from the 10th century, this group came from up north. So guess what? They were the descendants of the first wave. This group, however, after 500 years up north, had been exposed, integrated, and adopted the cultures, and through intermarriage, etc., were therefore a blend of the initial southern wave that went up and the Nkole, Bunyoro, and Toro communities up north. They then brought these influences with them as they came back home, and their migration was strongly linked to the not so friendly encounters with the ancestors of the Luo community who were migrating from the northern regions of today's southern Sudan. By the 16th century, these various movements of people, once they were more or less settled, I mean it had been over 10 centuries, then we find the Hinda dynasty was established by none other than, yep, Rohingya. He was said to have deposed the reigning Basita clan's ruler, Nono, who was Malija's son and Mungunguru's grandson. The Basita dynasty had been in power for these three reigns, starting from about 1400 and ending around 1475. Rohingya, once in power, set up the command center for Karagwe at his capital that we heard about earlier. And it is from this power base that he and his sons then went on to solidify the Hinda dynasty's dominance in the region through various methods of conquest. So let's put a short pause in there, as I want to come back to the dynasty and rulers in a few. But first, I think now would be a good idea to briefly chat about the religious beliefs of the kingdom. I promise this will all make sense. There are a few aspects to the religious practices held in Karagwe which are interesting, and we see the mix due to the number of strong influences and cultures that were present. Starting with one of the strong beliefs held by the Banyambo, who in turn we see as having been heavily influenced by the Bahinda dynasty. And this was the stronghold of the beliefs and the homage paid to the Chwezi spirits, such as Wamara, Kagoro, Nkumba, and Dahura. The kingdom's population held the spirits in reverence, and there were shrines built to honor them, as well as buildings such as the sacred buildings, the Kagondo, which house religious symbolic artifacts like the sacred drum that we've already heard of, Nyabatamba. Moving to the holders of the rituals, the kingdom had spiritual leaders and high priests who were akin to demigods, I kid you not, and they were elevated to hallowed spirits when they passed on. These roles were hereditary, handed down from generation to generation. They played a key role in the kingdom and are highly respected for their powers. They presided over the key rituals and sacrifices and were both then and now thought to be imbued with the power to make it rain. Always a great one, right? They were also considered to have the power to cause either good or bad fortune to befall people, so no one really wanted to mess with them. Then there was a strong link between the kingship and religion. You see where this all comes together? A sacred kingship which had been introduced by the Bahima. They are credited with the embedding of sacred symbols of rule such as the drum, a really integral part of not just religion, but also of rulers. Then you had the Imana, and then add to all of that, the royal instrument of war, the spear. And as we're here at Spears, because we do love these links at Afriware too, this is a good one. The other important aspect that touches on both religion and kingship is the magic of metallurgy. This region was renowned for their ironworks, and Karagwe is reputed to have been one of the earliest sites with some of the best metal artifacts in Eastern Africa. To this date, pieces from the kingdom are held as valuable works of contemporary history collections. The most valuable come from Omugabe Ndagara's own personal collection. A little bit more on him later in the next section when we look at rulers. So what does all of this have to do with religion? I hear you ask. Well, in Karagwe society, blacksmiths were believed to hold magical powers, and not only were they revered, but as expected with any sense of magic, one had to be initiated into the group, and the secrets of smithing were held within them. And adding even more to the air of mystery, as well as being part of everything else, is the fact of religious societies. So for blacksmiths, what they used as their tools, as well as what they created, included objects which were used in the rituals and practices, representing the dyadic, which is a fancy word for something that is composed of two parts or elements, structure of the kingdom's religion, male and female. One of the best examples of how their smithing represented this dyadic element was their instruments. From the bellows and the furnaces, these were, and still are, identified as being symbolic of the male and female in terms of the gender roles and genitalia, as well as that of fertility. How the two interacted with each other, the smelting process was seen as akin to procreation. Now, Afriwatu, there's a whole deeper and detailed study on blacksmithing on the continent that looks at the different regional symbolisms and practices for Karagwe and other cultures, which is really, honestly, fascinating and has been done by much smarter African historians and anthropologists than I. So please, please, please go check it out. But for now, allow me to move you along to meet the rulers of Karagwe. We'll be right back. So here we are at the Omugabes of Karagwe, the rulers. And we're better placed to start than one who became, than how one becomes a ruler, right? So, succession was through the Bahima dynasty's royal bloodlines, where the incumbent Omugabe would select his successor. The next ruler was then verified once there was consultation with the Council of Nobles. Once the successor had ascended to the throne, he was then entrusted with two key royal regalia items that accompanied his position. Nyabadama, the royal drum, and the everlasting fire, both of which were housed in Kagondo, the sacred hut. The Omugabe's duties spanned from being the kingdom's provider to his protector, using the powers he had to hand. And a fun tidbit for all of you, these powers are not just administrative, but also magical. There are a number of stories around the magic. One that really struck out was the tale of how an Omugabe from ancient days, in order to protect his people from an advancing army, he used his power, sticking the ground, and a lake formed. This large water body then blocked the enemy. Now, I searched and searched, but I couldn't find which ruler this was. So please, my people from Karagwe, let us know who. But back to the more mundane. In his role as protector, this also covered his responsibility over the industrial strength of the kingdom. And one of the most recognizable ways was the mastery of smithing. We spoke of this before and how it was a key element in not just religion, but also kingship. At the coronation of the new Omugabe, this was reinforced through the ritual drumming of the Nyabatamba. It was struck by both the new king, and that was symbolic of the smith's hammer working the iron on an anvil. The other party to strike the royal drum was a Sindhi clan member. And we shall come back to clans in part two when we look at society. So please remember to tune back in for that. Other rituals that the Omugabe took part in addressed different requirements for his people. One was in how he managed and balanced the interests of the often dicey relationships between the powerful and influential social groups, from the farmers to the blacksmiths, from the religious leaders to the traders, and so on and so forth. He leant a lot on the symbolism of the smelter to mediate and assert power over all these groups. He also used rituals to reaffirm and remind all of his power, and this was done during the, I'm sure I'm going to mess this up, Okusibana, which is the new moon ceremony. And this is when he would renew the kingdom's prosperity with the promise of bumper harvests and increasing livestock production. Recent records show that the Okusibana was performed outside of the Karundinda shrine. The Nyabatama was central to the ceremony, being the sacred royal drum. And in keeping with the importance of metallurgy in this kingdom, part of the ritual performed included the use of the sacred copper or brass anvil. So as we wind up on the Omugabes, I think we can safely see how integral ironworks are to the Karagwe rulers. So with this in mind, I wanted to highlight one of the more famous, well-known rulers, Omugabe Ndagara, who reigned from circa 1820 to 1853. Ndagara was known to be a highly skilled blacksmith, with one of his celebrated works being a valuable sculpture of a sacred Ankole cow, with signature long horns that symbolize wealth and fertility, and that has been preserved till today. People, you can go and see it. One of his contributions to history is also his vast collection of art pieces, sacred sculptures, cultural artifacts, which have been studied and collected. There are questions as if he did all the pieces himself or not, which highlights the secrecy around the magic of smithing production in that period. But before we wind up, because yes, I know it's the end of this particular episode, I wanted to share an interesting thing said around how secret this smithing production was. The Omugaba's royal smiths were said to be from the Abakama clan. And get this, it is claimed that the way in which he ensured the secrets of smithing remained exactly that was that he had, listen to this, my people, he had the smith's eyes plucked out. Yep, you heard right, plucked out, like right out. Now, is this truth or is it malicious propaganda? AfriWet would love to hear from our Karagwe fam. Please let us know. And with this, let's leave the rulers and their eyeballs as we close off part one. So before we bring it home, what else was going on in the world at this time? So between 1870 and 1890, there's a long depression in Western Europe and North America. Between 1895 and 1898, the Cuban War for Independence resulted in Cuban independence from Spain. In 1883, the quagga is rendered extinct. And the quagga is, and I'm going to read this description, is a subspecies of the plains zebra that was endemic to South Africa until it was hunted to extinction in the late 19th century. And this was after the European settlement of South Africa began. They hunted them extensively. And now to bring it home. This was such a great kingdom to research, and it was like a mystery search because there was not a lot of information out there. In fact, a lot of it, if not all, was sourced mostly from the book The Making of the Karagwe Kingdom by Israel K. Katoke, published in 1969. I know that AfriWetu also used that as a major source for this particular kingdom. But even that, in the study of this civilization, I did come across some other very interesting articles, and one of them was written by Scott McKern in 1996. And this is where I learned about ethnoarchaeology, a term I'd never heard of before. But that's not what I want to talk about here as we close off. I wanted to highlight something that he said that really resonated as an African looking at her ancestor stories. He said, and I quote, "There is a continuing danger that the academic investigation of recent African lifeways for the purpose of gaining understanding of the practices of past societies contributes to the historical objectification of Africans. The analysis of African communities as specimens of a vanished past." He continues, "This establishment of conceptual relationships between past and present is especially laden with Western cultural baggage and preconceptions where Africa is concerned." I want that to sink in for a moment. So there are many ways in which we can take out this, but what I wanted to highlight, at least for AfriWetu, is that what this warns us against, but unfortunately still the case, is this view of Africans as one homogenous group of people, of us as one-dimensional, of us with no depth, and of us being purely an interesting academic study from which to draw narrow and sterile conclusions of who we were and who we are now. This is not my ancestors, nor our story. And on that note, let's reflect back on the mystery and the mastery of the secrets of ironworking and sign off with the final clang of the smith's hammer on the anvil. And until next time, Mubarikiwe!